Okay, perhaps we should make a start now. Welcome to this lecture. Welcome on behalf of the Hellenic Observatory, of which I'm the director. I'm pleased to see so many of you here. I know that you're from diverse backgrounds, different degree schemes, students at the LSE, visitors to the LSE, etc. And you all are all most welcome. I'd like to welcome in particular the students of LSE Entrepreneurs and to thank the Society, LSE Entrepreneurs, for their help with this evening's lecture and with the publicity. I understand this lecture follows the schedule of last week in which LSE Entrepreneurs had a week devoted to entrepreneurship, National Entrepreneurs Week. I'd also like to welcome those people from the LSE Business Society. You're all most welcome. In some respects, of course, tonight's speaker needs no introduction. He is one of the most successful young businessmen in the UK. He's practically a household name. At 37, he's often identified simply as Stelios. And we all know who that means, who that refers to. Mr. EasyJet, the man who created the low-cost, no-frills airline with such business success. And his business success has indeed been very impressive. The son of a successful businessman himself, Stelios Hadjioannou has founded a number of companies. His first company in 1992, Stelmar Tankers, which follows a family interest in shipping. He created EasyJet in 1995. 3 years later, EasyJet became part of a wider identity, Easy Group, and we have seen the creation of parallel ventures, Easy Internet Cafe, Easy Car, Easy Value, Easy Cinema, and most recently, I think, Easy Bus. And Stelios Hadjioannou is chairman of each of these companies, and reportedly he takes a very active part in their daily operation, very much hands-on. He retains, according to the press, a stakeholding of more than 40% in EasyJet, and the family share in Stelmar Tankers is reportedly 20%. Very much involved in his business creations. We know all this from the press. But perhaps we don't know so well the fact that his career and success started here at the LSE. He is a graduate of the economics department, a BSc in economics, from the school in 1987. He then went on to take an MSc at City University Business School. And so the school is where his professional career began, and we take pride in his business success. Tonight, I presume that we will learn much more about his career and his business strategy, his motivations, his calculations and strategy. Easy Group, is this a hobby, a serial addiction? Does he think of life beyond Easy Group? What is his strategy and priorities for the future? And yes, given that this is a lecture of the Hellenic Society, the Hellenic Observatory at the LSE, then we look forward to comments about the connection between his business strategy and his family background in Cyprus and Greece. So we look forward to this lecture very much. Let me simply explain that Stelios Hadjioannou is going to speak relatively briefly, so that there's plenty of opportunity for you to ask questions thereafter. I'm going to step down from the stage in a moment, and my colleague Bob Hanke from the European Institute will chair the session of questions and answers at the end of the presentation. But before the questions and answers, before all of that, please give a very warm LSE welcome to our distinguished alumnus, Stelios Hadjioannou.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much. This theater did not exist when I studied here. By mistake, before I arrived here, I walked into the old theater, which is where I sat down as a student in September 1984. So it's a little over 20 years ago that I arrived in London from Athens, having been through primary and high school education in Greece, and having taken my A levels. And I remember I was really petrified walking into that old theater, you know, not knowing what to expect of this institution. It was quite something walking back in there. Anyway, this is a more pleasant environment, so delighted to be here too. I'd like to just ask a couple of questions. I always believe that it's better to know a bit about your audience at least. So let me ask first, how many of you are actually current students at the LSE, by show of hands? All right, big, overwhelming majority. And how many of you would like in the next, well, given your age, I should say, in the next 10 years, how many of you in the next 10 years would like to run your own business? Excellent. So they're all entrepreneurs. Fantastic. All right. Well, you've heard already that I cheated at the beginning. I had a bit of a head start because my father gave me the money. So the first bit of advice is find a rich father. Get adopted, whatever. on a more serious note, what you should be doing is actually going to a VC. Now, the fact that my venture capitalist, if you like, the guy I went to at the age of 25, and I said, I think there is a better way to run a shipping company, or I'm going to create a better shipping company than yours, happened to be my father, and that's why he was so receptive. But essentially, I just raised venture capital from him. I didn't carry on working in the family business. I wanted to do my own thing. I wanted to be my own boss. I don't know if you believe in that theory about the second born in a family being typically the rebel, but I'm also a second born. I have an older brother who stayed in the family business, and I'm the one who wanted to do my own thing. So 12 years ago, at the age of 25, I started Stelma, a shipping company that's now making the headlines for the wrong reasons. It's in the middle of a very bitter takeover battle on the New York Stock Exchange. And it's all very useful and interesting and a bit of fun, so I'll give you a very brief summary about where we are on that, and then I'll move on to the easy branded businesses that are consumer-facing and you're more likely to be familiar with them. And as you said, I'm only planning to speak for 15 minutes and then I'll open it up for questions. So Stelma, a tanker company, sort of created 12 years ago, delegated myself out of a job within 2-3 years because I came here to start EasyJet, found some people I thought I could trust. These people took the company from a startup to being floated on the New York Stock Exchange in 2001, and then growing further into becoming today a company with 40-plus ships, oil tankers, worth about $700 million. Now, all of that sounds like a wonderful success story. What went wrong somewhere in the middle is that these people I trusted felt enough autonomy to start breaking the rules, if you like. So I found myself in the unpleasant situation of having to engineer a change of regime, a change of management from the outside. So whilst I relinquished control, because that's what I do, I'm not a day-to-day manager of companies, I like to create them and then let that go, I sort of had to find a way of changing these people from the outside. So I tried to engineer a merger, which they resisted. Then they sold the company to the wrong buyer. So we took it to a shareholder vote, and a couple of weeks ago, by overwhelming majority, we turned that down. And now we're in sort of round three, if you like. So it's all unusual. You know, you're sort of fighting the people you used to work with and you trusted. But I think it's all part of a healthy capitalist society, because, you know, tension and acting in your own self-interest is sometimes what makes this system work. So it's people all individually trying to do the best for themselves that makes the system work. The outcome will be decided, in my view, in the next couple of months, and you know, the company will change hands, hopefully to the right, merge with the right entity to carry on. But anyway, that's probably one of the less successful delegation exercises. Let's talk about some of the more fun stuff. EasyJet started in 95. Literally, I sort of got bored creating Stelma, the shipping company, so I looked around, what else can you do? And I was approached by a couple of Greek guys that had the franchise for Virgin Atlantic in Athens. So it was, those of you from Athens will probably remember flying on that aeroplane operated by Virgin between Athens and London. And they said they want some money to grow. It was a franchise of Branson's company. And I looked at the possibility of investing, and my instinct at the beginning was the right one: don't invest in airlines. Warren Buffett has been known saying that for the benefit of shareholder value, the Wright brothers should have been shot down when they took off from Kitty Hawk. Aviation should never have been invented for the benefit of shareholder value. There are exceptions. EasyJet is one of them, but typically airlines do not make money. So my first instinct was not to invest in that venture, but then obviously I got carried away by Branson and his image and the fact that he looked as if he was having fun, and I started looking for the right strategy. How do you get into the airline business? And there comes another lesson. I basically headed for the United States. I looked west. So I didn't look at my own backyard. I didn't try to do it in Greece with Olympic Airways or something like that. I said, if there is the right business model, we'll find it in the States. And there is a company called Southwest Airlines, which started in the 70s, and it's the world's most valuable airline. It's a low-cost airline. Now, they invented the thing. It's been around since the 70s. So I went to the States, I had a good look at Southwest, came back to Europe, went to Dad, and said, can you give me some more money? I want to start a low-cost airline. And he obliged. It was a good investment, mind you. It has paid off. Now, the main point here is that there is a right and wrong way of entering an industry, and there is always an opportunity to improve on something. Airlines are divided in two camps. What they're known as hub-and-spoke airlines, which is like British Airways, like KLM, like Air France, that fly people from anywhere to anywhere via an airport, a hub, Heathrow, Charles de Gaulle, Schiphol, whatever it's called. And then they are chronically loss-making because they're competing with each other and the prices come down and they fly the flag rather than focus on shareholder value. So they are the wrong business model. And then you have the point-to-point one where you say, we will only do one thing and we'll do it well. We'll fly short flights, high frequency, low cost, without frills, sailing direct to the consumer, and doing all the things optimized around the point-to-point network. And I can claim that I've innovated in two particular respects. The first one is EasyJet became the first airline in the world to sell coffee on an aeroplane. Sounds like a very simple thing to do, but up until 1995, everybody was giving away stuff on an aeroplane. Nobody thought of actually selling it. The other thing is I was lucky enough that when I decided to actually go direct to the consumer, to cut out the intermediary, the middleman, the travel agent, started in 95 with a telephone, call centers, taking bookings over the phone. And I was fortunate enough that in 98, the internet came of age. And with the internet, it became a lot more scalable, a lot more profitable, because you took out another margin of the business. So I was lucky to be at the right place at the right time with the right father and the right deregulation in the industry. With the internet coming of age and enough capital to see it through to profitability and eventual flotation. So in 2000, 5 years after the first flight, the company floated on the London Stock Exchange. It's now a significant company. The market cap now is about £800 million. And it's run by professional management, one that I trust so far. So until proven otherwise, The point is that, again, there is a point in the career, the development of a company when you might not be the best person to run it. You may have to actually go out and find professional managers, people with more experience, who have run big companies, who have the patience and the skill to actually organize a large operation. And EasyJet today is almost 100 aircraft, 25 million passengers a year, 4,000 employees. You know, it's a complex machine. It's not something you should be doing part-time, like I would have been doing it. And there comes the title of the speech, this business of addiction. I realized that there's another personality trait of mine, which is I get bored easily, basically. I just wanted to try something different. So, you know, armed basically with the profits, if you like, of my earlier ventures, I said, what else can I do? And I looked at this concept that, again, Branson has been very good at, which is extending the brand. How do you take a name from one industry to the other, to the other, to the other, and try and focus on intellectual property rather than assets, hard assets, fixed assets? Started in shipping, which is probably one of the oldest, you know, old economy industries. It's booming at the moment, but it's very old economy, very cyclical, based on, you know, ships made of steel, to aeroplanes, which have soft values like brands and everything else, but essentially still a very capital-intensive industry. If you want to grow the business, you have to buy another aeroplane. So every time you want to increase revenues and profits, you have to add another asset to the company. So I've moved on and said there is another better business model, which is the one you concentrate on the intellectual property, on the brand. Now, when do you know you have a brand? Well, I'm not sure it's well-defined, but I felt we had a brand after British Airways picked a fight with us back in 98. I could feel it. I could sense it. You know, by walking around, people came to me and said, you know, good on you, you know, up theirs and that sort of thing. So, you know, you're creating a sort of an emotion, you're creating an emotional attachment to a name when, you know, as a founder and the face of the company, you get that sort of reaction. You need an enemy, especially if that enemy happens to be a national icon like British Airways. So, being picked on by a national icon and being the little guy fighting the big guy is what creates that sort of brand equity, that sort of intangible thing that a name acquires at some stage in its career, in its life. And then I started applying it on different things with different degrees of success. I mean, I'm not going to stand here and tell you everything I've ever done has been profitable and successful. I've made some huge mistakes. So my third business, if you like, was a child of the frenzy of the internet era, a dot-com. Well, it wasn't a dot-com, but behaved like a dot-com, in the sense that I had this idea of putting computers in a shop, putting a coffee corner and calling it an internet cafe. I think my thinking was, the internet is doing well, Starbucks is doing well. Can you imagine if we combine the two? It would be a killer. Anyway, in reality, it was a retailer. I mean, internet cafes is about retailing, it's about shops, it's about controlling your costs, it's about, you know, running decentralized, you know, operations and multi-unit things, which I had no experience whatsoever back in 99. Hired some people, again, probably not the best choice at that stage. Gave them too much authority too early. Over borrowed, you know, leverage was practically free at that time. You can just, especially someone with, you know, a bit of a name, a reputation, could go to any bank, any venture capitalist, any computer manufacturer like Hewlett Packard and say, you know, here is a business plan, can you fund it? And everything got funded. It doesn't mean everything succeeded. It shouldn't make you feel any worse if you're starting tomorrow or in a couple of years, because it is, capitalism works in a way that becomes a filter, that sort of the barrier is lowered when the frenzy is there, but quite a few more fail, and the barrier is higher if the frenzy is not there, but more of them succeed. So your odds are not actually that different. So anyway, that company overextended itself, went to too many countries, you know, 8 countries, 13 cities in a year and a half, which is crazy by any retailing standards. If you're planning to start a retailing business, don't do it. Don't go to 8 countries in a year and a half. It just doesn't work. So, again, for a split second, I had a dilemma. It's overborrowed, over-leveraged. Do I let it go under? And I said, no, there's a bigger picture here. There's a brand which I have to protect. So I stood by my mistake. I stood by my company, and I said, no, I'm going to pay the debts off and carry on. In a smaller business, more sort of humble than I thought it would be, but now it's breaking even, washing its face, you know, promoting the brand in the high street. Still sort of attracting about 10 million customers a year. So that is, you know, my confession. That is my mistake. I still believe there is a very sort of unique element of brand extension to brand extension as a business. It's fascinating because you're doing something new all the time. You're trying to find the brand values and how they fit in different industries. And that I find exciting. So how do you interpret Easy Hotel, for example, which is something we're doing? Is it big rooms, small rooms, orange rooms, blue rooms? Is it with room service, without room service, with a television, without a television, with windows, without windows, with bed linen, without bed linen? You know, that's my job. I try and apply the brand to different industries, make mistakes, back out, correct course, go back in, try again. You know, I have this luxury as an entrepreneur, as a private person, to be able to experiment and take risks that way. By the way, I believe it is the privilege of an individual to actually act as an entrepreneur. I don't think companies should be that entrepreneurial. You know, corporate entities with managers who don't have a stake in the business should not be playing around like that. And that's why it's mostly the privilege of individuals to actually start companies with that sort of strategy. So all in all, and I don't want to bore you because I'm ready to take questions, 12 different industries now, ranging from travel and leisure, which I think is where the brand started and is strongest. So is it car, is it bus, is it hotel, is it cruise, we're starting now. Cinema, DVD rentals, internet cafes and leisure, in my view, and travel, because tourists go and pick their emails, and it's a way of spending time. And then I've extended it further into financial services, credit cards, we're negotiating for an insurance product, personal loans, telecoms. It's a big piece in the Financial Times today about mobile telephony and how we're trying to make a difference in that area. How you use the internet to reduce the cost of buying airtime and separating the frills, which is the handsets and the gizmos and the 3G technology from basically simple airtime and text messages which you buy over the phone prepaid. Sorry, over the internet prepaid. And you buy the SIM card and you just put in your own handset. And the least expected brand extension, which is starting next month, is actually called Easy for Men. Can and it's not what you think. it's actually a range of men's toiletries. And the way it has happened is Boots, you know, this icon of British retailing and, you know, the largest chemist, if you like, in the country, came to us and said, we believe there is a gap in the market for a range of products like shaving foam, like aftershave, like shampoo, soap, etc., for the no-nonsense man. The man that is not interested in advertising by David Beckham. You know, like Gillette would pay Beckham a lot of money to hype up the product so they can sell it for twice the price. So they're saying, you know, there is a brand that stands for value for money, and it does what it says on the tin. Remember that advert? And, would like to license your brand rather than try and build it from scratch. I mean, Boots have a name. It stands for different things. It stands for, you trust them to give you medicine or whatever. They are reliable. They are established. They've been around for 150 years. So their brand is not ideal for targeting that audience. And that's where I see much of my own growth in other areas, in the sense that, you know, I can't anymore be an expert in all of these industries. So I have to find the right partners. I have to find companies that have the know-how but lack the brand. And we share the risk and somehow do what's known as a brand license. So basically a contract, an arrangement between us how to share the risks and the rewards. And I think that has better chance of succeeding than if I started and took all the risk myself in an industry I know nothing about. I learned shipping from my father. I learned aviation the hard way. I'm now trying to get into becoming a brand manager. And you know you have a brand, not when people talk to you in the street, which also helps, but when people start to pay for it. The ultimate test is, you know, Boots, Tele Denmark in the case of mobile telephony, Lloyd's TSB in the case of financial services, say, I want to offer a product or a service under your brand, not under mine, and I'll pay you for doing it. So that's where I am at the moment. Before I take questions, I'll leave you with one joke, just to finish on a lighter note. My introduction made a big thing about how hands-on I am. So back in the early days of EasyJet, I used to answer the phone. You know, we didn't even have emails back then. And one of the customers sort of insisted, left two or three voice messages saying, I'm a big fan, but I have a problem. Can you call me back personally? So I called him back. Company was still small, so I could do that. So I said, how can I help you? He said, I'm a big fan. I've even booked my honeymoon with you. But unfortunately, my engagement broke down. Now, remember, we have non-refundable fares. So I thought the guy was asking for money back. So I said, okay, under these exceptional circumstances, since you got through to me, I'll give you the money back. So the guy says, no, I want to change the name of the person traveling with me. On this note, I'll answer your questions. Thank you.
Let me take.
We have roving mics as well. Is that a roving mic? Yeah.
Let me take the privilege of the chair and ask you one question, so that all the others can settle for a moment. Most of the business. Am I right in thinking that most of the businesses that you're moving into are reasonably well-established sets of markets, and that you find a niche there? Is there something inside you that says there's always a better way to do something which is already done? Or are you now slowly moving into areas where you say, I'm going to start doing entirely new things?
Well, I've done both extremes and everything in between. And let me remind you of the examples. The airline business was regulated. It was a series of national monopolies. And I was lucky that the skies were opening up in the early 90s for a new business model to come in. So EasyJet, when it started, was truly novel. It was highly, in many respects, very, very different, highly atypical of the industry at the time. Back then, we estimated we had a 50% cost advantage, which is not, it doesn't happen every day in life, to be able to start in a new business and have a 50% cost advantage. So it only happens when, you know, there is regulation and government monopolies that are inefficient. In internet cafes, I tried to invent an industry that didn't exist. I mean, the internet cafes did not exist as a concept at all, except a few gigs playing around. And I said, I'm going to make it a chain. I'm going to make it an industry. I'm going to make it an international retailer or international high street player. And you know, it cost me a lot of money. So, you know, it's a risk-reward equation. You try and stay close to the existing business model. It's safer. You know, you take a credit card. You know, the cost of servicing customers over the branches and the phone and paper statements is X. If you do it all on the internet like we do it with Easy Money, it's cheaper by 20%. You know, that's enough of a margin to make a living. You know, you need a bit of both. I mean, you can't start a revolution 16 times in a row and succeed.
Good.
Yeah.
Yes, please. You first.
Yes.
I can probably hear you, actually. Why don't you carry on? Yeah. Huge. I would have been running a souvlaki shop chain in Greece. Maybe a big chain, but it would have been a souvlaki shop chain. I would still have been an entrepreneur, but I just, you know, you need capital to start these businesses. Yeah, I mean, that's why he's to be admired more than what I've done. And I've always believed self-made people are in a class of their own. My father is self-made. But, you know, I've decided in terms of positioning, just to get it out quickly, so you establish at least some credibility with the audience that I'm not self-made. You know, remember that. The gentleman over there. Yeah. The business model of EasyJet is ideal on short flights. It's at its best. It has the maximum comparative advantage on a short flight. London, Amsterdam, you know, 40 minutes in the air, nobody cares about food, nobody cares about legroom, nobody cares about help from a travel agent. Because remember, one of the ways you save money is direct sell. Now, you're more likely to venture into Amsterdam without the help of a travel agent than to venture into China without the help of someone from London. So, short haul is ideal. You know, the turnaround time is a bigger part of the time of the asset, the aeroplane, how much time it spends on the ground. When you fly long haul, all airlines are efficient because once the aeroplane is launched, it's in the air for many hours. Fuel becomes a much bigger expense. My theory about long haul is that probably the other business model is better because you get subsidization of the back of the plane from the front of the plane as well. So you have, you know, one-third of the real estate being devoted to business passengers who pay a fortune because their companies pay for it, and then the back flies for well below cost. I mean, like well below cost. So, you know, you can fly to New York now, what, for £400, £500? Easily, if not less. Does it answer your question?
Somewhat, yeah.
So, what sort of airline do you want to launch then? Tell me. Well, how do you see that? The lounge is not that expensive on that product. What you're really paying for is real estate on the plane. That seat you sleep on business class, is occupying the same space as four of the others.
But is it worth £3,000?
It doesn't matter what it's worth because companies are paying for it. That's the point. It's the employers who pay for it. So it's sold above, well above the cost of production to subsidize the back. So, it's... Virgin Atlantic is a successful company for that reason, probably. Branson started and managed to survive 20 years now by taking them on in their own game and playing it very well. You know, it's not that dissimilar, actually. You know, BA is blue and Virgin is red, but essentially they're running the same business model with a bit more flair and bazaars, and it works. Why change it? So I don't see a need for a low-cost, long-haul exclusively low-cost, long-haul carrier. But you might prove me wrong. The lady at the back.
Thank you for a great lecture. A bunch of us from CAS Business School, MSc in Shipping, Trade and Finance.
My other alma mater, yeah?
Exactly. Of course, we look forward to seeing you at our university, but if you can brief us a bit more on your outlook on the shipping industry and whether you see yourself setting up some more companies since the market seems to be booming.
Well, my father used to tell me, if the market is booming, you sell, you don't buy. But I think actions speak louder than words. So the whole story about Stelma and the vote in New York last week was about not selling. So I clearly feel bullish enough to turn down the offer and say, we'll roll the dice and carry on. Because the market is good. Actually, the share price has gone up more than 10% now. It's almost 13-14% up in the last week. So There will come a time in shipping you have to sell, and you know, I'm not sure I can call that moment. And my father used to say, you know, timing is everything. So if you buy low and sell high, you'll make money in shipping. If you do it the other way around, you go out of business. I'm more likely to invest and expand in consumer-facing businesses. So, you know, I'm happy with my investment in the Stelmar, the tanker company, but I'm more excited about shipping in the form of Easy Cruise because it's consumer-facing, it's brand-enhancing, it's fun. You know, we already agreed with BSkyB, the satellite broadcaster, to do a whole docu-soap on the cruise line, like the one that exists for airline on ITV. So, you know, I think that form of shipping probably fits my priorities and my skill set more than, you know, going back into dry bulk carriers. A lady first. You must be Irish, are you? Great. Michael is extremely successful in what he does. Michael O'Leary, he's the chief executive of Ryanair. He's not an entrepreneur in the sense that he was hired by Tony Ryan to run the company, so he's the hired gun. He's actually never put any money in. He's been successful and he's been taking money out, but he's not an entrepreneur. Now, he's built this profile because he figured out that's how you get free publicity. I think he's running a risk, and you might be able to help me look at the sort of the bravado in the context of being Irish, but he's running a very serious risk in other parts of Europe of offending his clients. He's just using the F word too often. And it might be appropriate for a pub in Ireland, but I'm not sure it's appropriate for the Financial Times. So, Michael is, you know, is driving the company very hard, keeping the costs down, telling consumers, you know, F off, you're not getting this, which, you know, might be going a bit too far. There was another guy called Ratner, General Ratner. I don't know how many of you remember him, but, you know, he offended his customers, and the customers deserted him at the end. You know, you can only go too far and push your luck that much in that direction. Also, I have doubts that whether that sort of brand extends naturally. I'll never forget when the Financial Times was trying, you know, they were trying to crack a joke about me extending the business into pizza delivery. Okay, Easy Pizza is starting next month, and you know, I think it's a neat thing to do, to use the internet to order the pizza delivery and pay different according to the price. So if you order it a day before, it's cheaper. If you order it at 4 o'clock, it's cheaper than at 8 o'clock. You see? You get it. The brand extension works. Now, when the FT was trying to crack a joke about it, said, we wonder what a Ryanair pizza delivery would look like. It would be served with verbal abuse. I got your effing pizza here. Momentum and commercial synergy. Put into context, what do you mean?
Commercial activity, do they have a common denominator which makes you want to go from one to another logically?
You mean on brand extension?
Yes.
Yeah. All right, I understood now. Every time I start a business, I have a choice, basically. I can call it XYZ pizza or XYZ bus or XYZ cruise or whatever, or call it Easy something. And I still believe I'm getting a head start by starting with a brand. I still believe that if you're faithful to the brand values, in other words, if you take the brand values that made EasyJet famous, low cost, fun, innovative, and for the masses, fighting for the little guy rather than being an exclusive elitist product, and if you transfer them faithfully and accurately into other industries, you're better off. You don't have to build a brand again. You don't have to spend the money with advertising. You don't have to wait for the business to build up. But it's not a guarantee of success because you may still screw up the execution. In other words, allow your cost to be higher and get it wrong. You may not interpret the brand properly. One example is on the cruise ship. I started by putting feelers out in the market and saying, bring your own linen. So I wanted to test whether people would go on a cruise carrying their own linen with them, so I can save money not having linen. And sort of we got a negative feedback on that. You know, people were saying, oh, hold on, I mean, we're on a holiday. Do we really want to sort of go on a holiday carrying our own bed linen with us? So, you know, you can go too far and get it wrong, and then you make a course correction. Now, if you're talking about cross-selling, is that what synergies are? Cross-selling is more difficult. I think it's overrated anyway, because EasyJet has shareholders, EasyCar has shareholders, EasyCruise has different shareholders. EasyCruise is 100% me. EasyJet is, you know, only 40% of the family. So any dealings have to be at arm's length anyway. So you can pay EasyJet for traffic, and occasionally we do, but it's like paying anybody else. It's cash leaving, you know, the company going into the other company, and you say, well, I can spend it with EasyJet, or I can spend it with Yahoo, or I can spend it with Google, or I can spend it on the Times, the newspaper. And you make judgments where you want to spend it. But synergy is not something you get automatically, I think. It's less obvious to me that it's worth a lot. It's the brand that matters. It's transferring the expectations. Let's take one from here. The gentleman in the tie. I mean, it's. I mean, yeah, I don't hire consultants. The question was, where do I find my ideas? Where do I get inspiration about which business to go into next? And the answer is, it's a combination of factors. The one that it's not, it's an expensive set of consultants who actually produce a study. So I've never hired McKinsey or someone like that to say, look at all the industries I can go to and tell me which one to go to. It just doesn't work that way. I believe that you have to keep your ears and eyes open, travel, look west, but not, you know, not exclusively. I mean, not everything in America translates very well here. And, you know, I've always made the point of making myself available, especially in email, to new ideas, because you never know where the next big one is going to come from. Let me give you two examples. I mentioned the one earlier. Boots. You know, it's not as if the chairman of Boots calls you and says, you know, I'm the chairman of Boots, let's do business. You usually get an email through a third hand, a friend of a friend, from someone in the men's department that says, have you ever thought of? And sometimes you're tempted to delete it because it sounds rubbish. And sometimes you're tempted to say, okay, let's read it again. Does it make sense? And then you get all the way. I mean, the bigger the company, obviously, the more, you know, attention you pay to what they say. But, you know, you do get the, you know, the student, high school student with a business plan of 2 pages says, can we start this or that? I mean, that you have to spend less time on. I was reading The Economist. I know The Economist is a very big part of the culture of this school. I started reading it religiously from 84. Highly recommended. And a year ago, they had a study about the similarities between aviation and telecom. So the telecom industry and the aviation industry. And on page 5 of the survey, they said that there are low-cost mobile telephony companies. There is one in Denmark called Telmor, which is the EasyJet of mobile telephony. So as soon as I read it, I was on a plane on a Friday night, as I normally find myself, and I sort of literally tore off the page and said, what is this Telmor? I better check it out. And I went on the website and it was all in Danish. So it was didn't quite make sense at the beginning. But, you know, one of the benefits of being relatively known is you do make contacts and you ask for introduction. And, you know, within a month or two, I was up in Copenhagen finding out more and eventually negotiating a joint venture with them. So, you know, you have to keep your ears and eyes open. Let's take the lady in the front row and then the gentleman behind. Yeah. Are you a current student? Yeah, carry on. Don't drop out. don't do a Bill Gates. I know he succeeded regardless, but you know, not everybody is that lucky or that clever. Bill Gates dropped out of Harvard to start Microsoft. Anyway, I've always said that, and I won't give you the typical answer, which is it helps you to think and everything else. It does. It gives you discipline. But I can give you a tangible example. I think I understood yield management very well, which is the process of changing the price, because I understood elasticity of demand. You know, you go to a marketing guy, an airhead, and you say elasticity of demand, and their eyes glaze over. They think of, you know, selling airline seats is about the Singapore girl and what sort of food you have on board. You start talking about the demand curve and how you want to capture every stage of it, and you know, every different customer has a different elasticity, and then yield management becomes, you know, comes to life. So I have learned things in academia, in academic life, that have been very useful in business. Gentleman behind? Yeah. Isn't that a contradiction in terms? I mean, shouldn't university degrees be hard and difficult, and you should study for them? You know, I don't know. It sounds like one of those scams on the internet that you send some money and they mail you a degree. On a serious note, I think it has to be consumer facing, and you have to remember who is the customer. The customer has to be the consumer. The problem with hospitals is that the customer is usually the government or the insurance company. So I'm not sure it's the best area. It's big business. I mean, people keep mentioning it, but you know, you have to think of your customer as being whoever pays, and not the consumer who is the person who uses the hospital. So it's a different type of business. I think for the time being, I'm going to stick to things like travel, leisure, you know, services like telecoms, personal finance. You know, I'm doing the odd experiment with products, you know, the cosmetic, the toiletries range with Boots. But, you know, I think I'm going to stick within those areas for the time being.
Would you think that this model would succeed in the Middle East? I mean,
Yeah, we've spent a lot of time thinking where else can you transplant it, because, as I said, it's not about long haul. It's not about flying London, Dubai. There are other airlines doing that. The question is, which market can you go and plant it in there? Naturally, you look at America, which is already competitive. Then you look at the two biggest countries in the world by population, China and India, which must be interesting because they're domestic markets. India is probably more receptive to foreign direct investment and probably more likely to uphold the rule of law than China. So that the priority there will probably be India before China. Now, the Middle East is, you know, fraught with difficulty. It's political instability, a lot of small fragmented countries, relatively small population bases. You know, the most open, Dubai, has a tiny, tiny population base. What is it, a few hundred thousand who live there permanently? And they already have a huge airline flying in and out of there. So on the margin, they can let another guy on the plane for relatively nothing. So, you know, in order of priority, I'd rather go to a very populous country rather than a place where there are a lot of wealthy people like the Middle East, but a lot of other risks and instability. Every time you fly from one country to the other, you need a special permission in that country, in those countries, in that part of the world. So it is tough. Let's go back there.
With the increasing usage of broadband, the price is going down. How do you see the future?
The broadband, yeah. I've learned that you shouldn't bet against technology. In the sense that, you know, it's amazing what technology can achieve given time. But none of the investments I make now in Internet Cafe are actually long-term investments or require a very long payback. I mean, we still franchise the concept. There are people who come and pay their hard-earned cash to buy a franchise to set up one. And I tell them, unless you get a payback in a couple of years, you know, don't do it. In other words, the horizon at any given time is fairly short, so you invest, you get the payback quickly before the technology sort of catches up on you. In the foreseeable future, to be interpreted as, I don't know, 2, 3, 5 years, I think there will be sufficient people who travel, who are away from their PCs, don't want to carry a laptop. BlackBerry is still too expensive for them, which is what, you know, executives carry now. So there is a niche again for people who would use it when they are on the move. And all you have to do to be convinced about that is just go to, you know, the third world and see how many there are there, still mums and pops. You know, China is full of internet cafes. Yeah, I nearly bought a cinema in Notting Hill, but I was trumped in the offer by an evangelical church. They make a lot of money, these guys. Obviously, they could make more money using the building as an evangelical church than they could using it as a cinema. So, and you don't argue with God. They all, you know. Yeah. So, let me answer the question fully. So they. The answer is I've tried, we haven't found the right building yet. I started with extreme difficulty. I mean, again, typical entrepreneurship attitude, entrepreneurial attitude. I started knowing that the suppliers would refuse product. I went into a business knowing that my suppliers would view me as an undesirable development and would not. The Hollywood studios refused to give us the blockbusters at the beginning, in the first run, in the first few weeks of their release. It took me about a year. I basically hired an industry veteran, someone who spoke the language, explained to them how it works. I reassured them that we're not going to discount the prime product. Yield management is not about discounting everything. It's about selectively discounting what's not selling. But the blockbuster at the beginning, it's, you know, several times more expensive. So, you know, if you pay £4.50 to see the latest blockbuster in the first weekend, it's still good value for money relative to someone else. It's, you know, 10 times more expensive than when you can see it if you're willing to wait for 8 weeks. And some people are willing to wait, some people are not. You know, some people are willing to book in advance, others are not. The industry as a whole is in turmoil because every single cinema chain has changed hands practically in the last year. So I'm still waiting to see where we fit in. But we've achieved the objective of getting the movies now. I've also added another line to the same brand, which is DVD rental, which is the business of the prototype there. Again, an example of an idea from America, Netflix. So you enjoy movies at home, cinema at home, by renting DVDs online from the internet.
What would you say has been... Okay.
It's better to use it so everybody else can hear your question, yeah. And I'll come... up there as well.
Okay, who would you say has been your role model so far or someone in the business world that you really admire?
Well, I don't think it's a single person. I've mentioned Richard Branson at least a couple of times in the speech, but I can think of as many things that I don't like about him than that I do. So, you know, nobody really, I would say, is exactly how I want to be, and I wouldn't advise that to you either. I can mention 4 or 5 names that I've admired and I've learned things from. People like the founder of IKEA, a guy called Ingvar Kamprad, primarily for his sort of being very humble, for his humility. He's a billionaire many times over and he flies EasyJet. So he's a very, 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 very down-to-earth guy. So I like him because he's a customer, you might say, but anyway. So Kamprad from IKEA, Michael Dell of Dell. I mean, amazing guy. He's only a couple of years older than me, and if you see what he's achieved, self-made, really, really amazing, amazing guy. Less well-known, the founder of Subway Sandwiches, which is the world's biggest franchisor now. He's taken, you know, he went from one sandwich shop to 20,000 in the space of 15, 20 years. You know, he had one idea, opened a sandwich shop. I mean, what's more simple than that? You know, you take one sandwich shop and you roll it out 20,000 times around the world. Very, very impressive guy. And the franchising is very close to what I'm talking about. You take a brand, an idea, and just roll it out with other people's capital. I've learned a lot from my father. I mean, I wanted to do the things differently in my own way and be my own man, but I've really learned a lot about market timing. I think I mentioned, you know, when to buy, when to sell, that sort of thing. If you look at the Stelma saga, you probably conclude that I don't have any because, you know, I've selected the wrong people or I don't know how to manage them or whatever. The relationship completely broke down. I think all you have to do is try, in the sense that, you know, you'll never be 100% successful. You will fire people occasionally that you've selected and they prove to be wrong. Speaking about role models, a guy who commands enormous respect in corporate America, Jack Welch, former boss of General Electric, actually insists that you should be firing 10% of your employees every year. You know, he says it's part of natural selection. You know, you need to actually, you know, sort of remove 10% of your workforce every year, so everybody has an incentive to try harder next time. So there are many ways to manage people. You know, some of them more cruel than others. Shall we take one from up there? Or you no questions, the gentleman.
Just mentioning China as a future opportunity for those to low cost airline.
Yeah. Yeah. Good.
I want to start a low-cost airline company like EasyJet 7 years ago. So do you have any suggestions from your point of view or your experience to make the brand more attractive to the VC? Because I don't have a
rich. You don't have a rich father, do you? Damn. There is a guy called David Nilleman who started JetBlue. So why didn't you read about him? In the sense, JetBlue in America, it's based in New York. It's about the same size. It started a few years later, so it's slightly smaller than EasyJet, but it's very, very successful. And he did it twice. He did one company to start with, and then sold it, and then did it again with JetBlue and a bunch of venture capitalists like Soros. So, you know, if you are a credible executive and you have a credible business plan, you can raise finance even for airlines. He raised, I think, $100 million to start JetBlue. That's my suggestion to you.
Thank you. What is the process you're going through from having an idea of the next place to take your brand to seeing it happen? And who are the sort of people involved? Is it part of a company that you're doing it now, or what are the practical?
It changes from industry to industry, but the Easy Group as such employs only about 40 people. So if you like, my private office, my holding company, has 40 employees full-time. The rest of the staff work for the companies or work for a partner company, a company that I don't even own. So, you know, the number of people who work on Easy for Men are, you know, in the tens probably, I don't know, hundreds. Most of them work for Boots. So we found a like partner. Now, I've tried disregarding industry expertise and I've paid the price for it, for that mistake. There is no substitute to combining someone's, you know, bright new idea with someone's solid experience from that industry. You need pilots to fly planes. You need captains to captain a ship. You need, you know, car rental people to know how to repair a car when it breaks down. You need, telecoms engineers to run a network. So, you know, you need to combine that skill set with entrepreneurial drive and marketing bazaars and all the other stuff. What was the intention? Why did we do it? For those not familiar, perhaps, with the story, Go was the offshoot of British Airways that EasyJet bought in 2002 for £376 million. Given today's valuations, you know, probably the price was a bit full. But you know, remember, we did it on the basis of our own valuation at the time, which was higher. So both valuations would have come down pro rata, if you like. The one company was valued off the other anyway. So we just gave a percentage of our shares to acquire Go. I still think it's the right thing to do, because had they stayed in the market, they would have remained a very powerful third force that would have gone public and raised a lot of money and then would have been another competitor in the market. They were identical to us. I mean, I've never heard, certainly not seen, such a seamless integration between two companies in a merger, because the British Airways people were just copying EasyJet. So when it came to put it together, it was just a question of a paint job. You know, you just paint the planes a different color, and you know, people knew what to do. People, you know, didn't have to change much else. So yes, I mean, had I had the chance again, I would have done it again. Well, if you read the papers today, the number is changing, but there are another 46, 47 low-cost airlines in Europe, self-styled low-cost airlines in Europe, people who call themselves low-cost airlines. So there is no shortage of people who are trying. I don't think the market, the airline industry will ever suffer from that. It attracts a lot of vanity capital, a lot of people who like the idea of running an airline, and that's why they're willing to risk a lot of money trying to get there. Now, my prediction is that half of those will go bankrupt in the next year, because not all of them can survive and not all of them will go through the next phase of capital raising. You know, it's one thing to put some money down and start. It's another thing to keep funding losses. So my guess is there will be a clear out, a consolidation. Actually, one went bankrupt yesterday in Italy. Excellent question. Again, let me bring everybody up to speed. But the way intellectual property law works is that if you have a trademark, in other words, if you've been granted a right by the government to use a name and you have a monopoly to a name, you can stop other people using it. Now, the fastest way to get a trademark is to construct a word that didn't exist before. Accenture, for example. You know, when they were thinking of a name to call what was Andersen Consulting, they came up with, you know, Altria, the name of Philip Morris. So they pay an expensive consultancy to come up with a word that didn't exist, and they trademark it, and they own that name. The problem is this name sounds stupid. So most of us actually use brands that are actually fairly common in as words in their origin. Virgin. You know, it's been around. Virgins have been around for a while, you know. So, McDonald's. I mean, how many burger joints are called McDonald's in Scotland? You know, or sell food. So, none of what you know you might think is a you know brand name that should never be touched is actually that original a word. It's just what it has become to signify. And it takes years to build a brand and a trademark. We're now 10 years old, nearly, and we have 500 trademarks. We didn't have any 6-7 years ago. And I think we did lose some goodwill with customers and the public when in the scuffle in the middle of the fight to actually keep some trademarks and stop people using it, we perhaps picked a fight with some smaller guys. But, you know, now, 10 years later, I think if someone in this country pretends that they've never heard of us and they think that starting Easy Fitness, Easy Gym or whatever is a fun thing to do and I'm going to do it anyway, well, I think they just don't understand how the system works. You know, you wouldn't start, you know, Virgin Buses, would you? I don't know. So It's how long it takes you to get there, and when do you actually know when to sort of fight someone and not fight someone. By the way, if someone has been there before, I can't fight them. There is a company called EasyNet. That really pisses me off that it's so confusing to the internet cafes. Actually, there are people who still call them EasyNet cafes. And, you know, there is confusion out there, but, you know, what do? You accept it because they started before us. But, you know, if someone tries to start today, that's entirely different. At the receiving end of that, Orange, the mobile phone company owned by France Telecom, is trying to stop me using the color orange. Now, what do you think about the merits of that case? Okay, hands up all those who believe we should be free to use orange in the mobile phones. Hands up. Nobody?
I don't
know. I don't know. All right. The gentleman in orange. Yeah. I think that that's probably the last question, is it?
Yeah. As long as you
well, want I, to go. All right. This and another one. Trying to think of an industry that has been severely disrupted by the internet. Actually, music is one of them. So I was trying to find an entry into that business. We had, again, a problem with the internet cafes downloading without our permission and illegally. We got into trouble. We paid the price. Now we're entering the downloads market officially with copyright paid and everything else. I also believe there is another side which is highly, highly unconventional, which I call copyleft, which is the opposite of copyright. So if someone wants to actually create a song, any piece of music, and want to publish it without actually being signed up for a contract with a record label and sign their life away, then that might be the right place for them. It's a marketplace for up-and-coming unsigned artists to promote their products, and people can download them for free. So they become famous and perhaps sign a proper copyright contract. So that's the angle I found in the music business. It's not obvious how we're going to make money out of it yet, but I think it's good for brand extension. And the last question there. Good question. We're looking at it. I think the betting model I like, in other words, the one that I believe, again, is disruptive and for the little guy and everything else, is the P2P betting, which is peer-to-peer, so Betfair. You're not a bookie. You're actually providing a marketplace for people to bet against each other. And I think that has some merit as a business model because it lowers the cost of betting. The bookie takes a spread for the risk he takes, whilst people can bet against each other for a much lower spread. All right? Thank you very much.